Welcome to The Sync Report, the intersection between filmmakers, content creators, and musicians, where we host a weekly conversation with some of the biggest names in film, television, music, and entertainment. Meet industry experts and top-level musicians as we pull the curtain back on music placement and scores, building vital relationships and providing real opportunities for our listeners. Listen to indie filmmakers and content creators present their latest productions and describe specific scenes as they consider music submitted by our audience. Hosted by film star and musician Colin O'Donoghue and his co-host, the godmother of independent films, Rose Ganguza, and The Sync Report's creator and music supervisor, Jason P. Rockwell. Don't forget, tell your friends about us and remember to rate, comment, and subscribe to The Sync Report on Apple and across all platforms. Music is the difference between a good film and a great one.
Welcome to The Sync Report.
Thank you, Milfredo and Willow, for that lovely introduction, and welcome to The Sync Report. Welcome back to The Sync Report and part two of our conversation with Peter Noon. Let's hear more of Peter's story.
How did your loving singing Buddy Holly's music get your band to change its name to Herman's Hermits?
We were in a pub. We used to rehearse in a pub in Withenshaw in Manchester. Because they let us rehearse there. They had a little stage and a microphone and a PA, so we could fit all our gear on the stage there. And once again, closing time, they closed at 3 o'clock and they opened again at 5:30. So we could get a couple of hours of rehearsal for free. And little things you say and do, which was my best Buddy Holly impersonation. And I used to put some horn rimmed glasses on. You know, because yeah. I thought that would make me look like Buddy Holly and sound like him. You know, that thing, you know, once you...
You were a lot cuter than Buddy Holly,
Peter. Oh, my God, was he?
I can say that.
That's all right. I don't mind being called. That's, you know, that's why they give you a menu in a restaurant.
Don't call him cute, Rose. Don't call him cute.
Rose, that's why they give you a menu in the restaurant so you can choose what you want. So I got my glasses on and I'm going, and he goes, he said something like, "What the bloody hell are you doing?" I stopped. I said, "Isn't it clear? Have you ever heard of Buddy Holly and the Crickets?" And he goes, "You're nothing like Buddy Holly.
Oh,
you're like you look like Sherman from the Bullwinkle Show."
Unreal.
And he may have said Herman from the Bullwinkle Show, but he meant Sherman from the Bullwinkle Show. Everybody on the stage was laughing, you know. And he said, "Why are you laughing? Heartbeats? You call yourself the Heartbeats? You should call yourself the Hermits. You look like bloody Hermits." So we got our name, Herman and the Hermit, and we went home afterwards, our drummer was Steve Titrington, and we could rehearse at his house because his sister was a police officer, and we could rehearse and stay all night. We could make a noise there because nobody could complain because she was the police. And we went back there, and his mum loved the idea, and she made potato sack suits for the Hermits. I said, "I'm not wearing that. I'm not a hermit. I'm Pete. No, I'm Herman." And they put these potato sacks on, and we did a gig at the Plaza the next day, Plaza in Manchester, lunchtime. And they wore these potato sacks with their little English, like, cotton hanging out of their underwear, hairy legs sticking out of these potato bags made out of potato sacking. And the drummer, whose mum had made them, shaved all the skin off his ass, and the guitar players had bleeding shoulder where they'd worn the straps over the thing.
Oh, no.
So that was the only time we ever wore them.
Wait, Peter, how did you get rid of the potato sacks?
I think they were left in the dressing room in a pool of like skin and
oh,
mayhem.
God, oh, no.
Disgusting.
Yeah, it wasn't a good thing.
Rose, raise the temperature here. Let's play something
we
that
have
might.
The Buddy, we have the yeah. Buddy Holly song you were singing that night.
Oh,
Milfredo, let's play Rave On by Buddy Holly.
Rave On, yeah, great.
Rave on, it's a crazy feeling, and I know it's got me reeling when you say I love you. Rave on.
Oh, God.
The way you dance and hold me tight, the way you kiss and say goodnight. Rave on, it's a crazy feeling, and I know it's got me reeling when you say I love you.
Can I ask you something, yeah. Peter? All of these musicians who are either preparing or have done Broadway musicals about their songs and their careers, has anybody ever approached you to do something like that?
I did one, and I had the greatest people available in the world. I had the writer who wrote Jersey Boys. I had the director who did Kinky Boots. I had the producer who did The King and I. And, you know, we opened in New Jersey. We got a bad review in the New York Times. It was called The British Invasion. And it was called My Very Own British Invasion. And it had me, Mick Jagger, and Marianne Faithfull in the opening scene. Me getting into the bag of nails when I was 17 or 16, which was this club. And, you know, it's still out there. They took it to England to try and get get it anglified.
Right.
Because, you know, I had to say to people, no, John Lennon wouldn't dance.
That's right.
You know, because they're Broadway people.
Yeah,
of course.
I saw you do Pirates of Penzance in New York, though.
Did you see that, Rose?
Of course I did. Yes.
Oh, my God.
All right, with Jim Belushi, we had so much fun. Was Jim still in it when you saw it?
Yep.
Wasn't it great?
Oh, my God.
Yeah. I saw when you opened. But it was really wonderful. Did you
Colin,
like
you just acted with Jim.
I did a movie with Jim a couple of years ago. He's great, isn't he? He's great.
Good lad.
Yeah, he's fantastic. Well, I wanted to ask Peter about the moment when you first heard I'm Into Something Good on the radio. What was that like? And can you remember where you were when you first heard it?
Good one. Yeah, we're actually in the club where we made Mickey Most come to see us. It was called The Beachcomber in Bolton. And it was called The Beachcomber because they had a wooden boat in the front window. There was nothing else that looked like a beachcomber. And a bottle of wine, Matthew's Rosé wine, in a straw thing. That was it. And we were upstairs in the kitchen where we used to change. We'd now been moved. We didn't change in the shade of the van back out at the back door. We were now allowed into the dressing room, which was the kitchen. And they didn't serve food at that time of the day. And we were changing in the kitchen, and it was 6:30. And a disc jockey had the number one music show in England at the time. And he opened the show with I'm Into Something Good by it. Again, Bliss, you know, that feeling of, for me, that was my dream come true. You know, when you make a record, all you want is to be heard on the radio. Remember, we have loads of friends in bands who've made records that never got on the radio. Great records as well. You go, oh my God, we could be one of those. So we've now got on the radio, which now puts us in the league with Roy Orbison and the Everly Brothers and all those people who live on the radio.
You're on the top shelf now, Peter.
Second, we've moved up to the third shelf now. There's a lot of shelves to go. We'll never get on the... The top shelf is Sam Cooke, Little Richard, Elvis Presley, and maybe Jerry Lee Lewis. There's no other people on the top shelf. So we're on the third shelf, and we decide, strangely enough, there's a bag of potatoes. Back to the potato thing. There is a bag of potatoes in the kitchen, because what else would English people do with potatoes except fry them and make chips? So they're there in the kitchen.
Or hook them at their audience.
They haven't been peeled. No, so there's a canal out the back. And on the other side of the canal is a derelict sewing machine factory with 90% of the windows broken. So we take that bag of potatoes and break all the other windows in that place. God. Celebration. It was abandoned, so it didn't matter.
I'm telling you, Peter Noon is a punk.
Well, that isn't really punkish. That's a.
It's so badass, Peter. You are so badass. It's incredible. Honestly, to go to do what you've accomplished, between the confidence, the not willing to bend or compromise, total punk behavior, and you were doing it before anybody.
Oh, believe me, I made loads of compromises. But remember, we were very lucky because we were independent by accident. Remember, we didn't have to have an A&R man and we didn't have to have a music supervisor. You know, it's an unusual situation. Only the Stones had that. You know, we ended up with a kind of deal like the Stones where we'd say, this is the single, this is the album. You know what I mean? A lot of people didn't have that opportunity.
No, they were all relying on the labels to develop them.
I was going to say, I feel like we should listen to a snippet of I'm Into Something Good.
Last night a man and you girl in the neighborhood. Oh yeah. Something tells me I'm into something good. Great song. She's the kind of girl great song. Who's not too shy. And I can tell I'm her kind of guy. She danced close to me like I hoped she would. She danced with me like I hoped she would.
So
you know, when I hear it, I'm back in the studio.
You were only 16 when it first aired.
Yeah, you know, and it sounds like it, doesn't it? And you know, the other guys in the band were young as well. There was two 17-year-olds, an 18-year-old, and a 20-year-old, and we were just kids. And that can be heard on the record how much fun. You know, everybody obviously said the most fun they ever had was at a Herman's Hermit session. And I was at a few Donovan sessions and I had fun at them too.
But don't you think, Peter, that that's where the story is? That's what the story is when you were, you know, that journey before, right before it becomes bigger than life. Maybe the story is, you know, the coming of age part of it before you became more famous than whatever, you know.
Look at the stories of all the other wunderkind, you know, the wunderkinder, the kids who make it when they're young, like David Cassidy and Davy Jones and all those child stars. The difference is they had some woman booking flights and buying gas for them and going shopping.
You
need to eat organic cheese and all that. Be careful. I didn't have any of that. I was the manager of the band for a long time. I had to get the van. I had to get the money. I had to pay the bills. So you learn very quickly. It's a humbling experience when you got to make ends meet.
Peter, I wasn't saying the music's not punk, but I do feel your approach, that term punk, is misunderstood because, you know, managing Joe Strummer, getting to know the guys from the Pistols and, you know, hanging out with Rat Scabies. And, you know, these guys were highly intelligent, mostly speaking out for human rights issues and equality. There was something super intelligent and they were standing up against the masses. And it feels just like your story is very much that, although the music is incredibly poppy and heartfelt. I just feel like there's something very anti-establishment.
What you're trying to say, Jason, is that there's more substance.
Totally. Thank you, Rose. Exactly.
I mean, when you talk about people like David Cassidy and people like that, those were like Hollywood inventions. Those were manufactured groups, or it's a completely thing. It wasn't real.
We didn't come along like that. People don't realize. They don't realize before we met Mickey Most with 3 years of work, and it wasn't all successful. You know, that's why you learn. You know, we couldn't do blues songs successfully, not because I couldn't sing the blues, but we couldn't play it either. We didn't know anything about it. We didn't know anything about that. It was somebody else's. We made a specific choice at the beginning to be completely pop. You know, at the Cavern, our set list had Mrs. Brown, You've Got a Lovely Daughter, and My Boy Lollipop. Nobody was singing My Boy Lollipop. No other bands would do. We had to find songs that no other bands would do, because there was a good chance that if another band did it, they did it better than us. We were in the we were learning curve right until we made it. And, you know, I think I finally woke up when I was about 50 and I go, oh, okay, this is what you do. I did it. I wasn't Herman for a long time, like for the Pirates of Penzance and all that stuff. There was a whole period. Then I had another band called the Tremblers. And I go on this, some guy's driving me crazy to play in Canada. You got to come play a state in Canada. It's a 3,000 seat. Oh, really? What's it called? Lulu's. I'm not playing a place called Lulu's. It sounds like a chitty bar. And he goes, no, no, no. It's like a big place. It's an ex-Walmart. So eventually they talked me into it. They said, we'll get a band who play all your songs exactly like the record. So I go, well, there you go. What have I got to lose? I'm going to do it. They keep harassing me to go and do this date. So I do it. I show up. And the first song is I'm Into Something Good. And in the guitar solo, I suddenly get this feeling. Oh, this is where you're supposed to be. This is what you do. Not Pirates of Penzance. This is what you do. You do this better than anybody else. You're the best Herman around.
Yeah.
You know what? I'm so glad to hear him say that just now, Rose, because honestly, I think one of the things, and I'm lucky because, you know, I got to build a relationship with Peter because of my relationship with Donovan. And so he's always been incredibly kind to me. But a man that has hit such heights, has been so successful, has millions of fans, the humility in everything he's telling us tonight is still mind blows. I don't know if most any human could go through what Peter's been through, and from such an early age to where he is now, continually being at the top of his game, be able to deliver his story with such humility. I think this must be one of the most endearing things about him.
But remember, I always said, I'm just the lead singer. They say, could you fix this? No, I'm just the lead singer. I don't know how to do anything except that. And interesting enough, we were so naive. And Donovan, you mentioned Donovan. We were both playing those seaside end of the pier gigs at two different places. And it was the height of pop stardom for Donovan. And I come out of my thing and I'm running away from like 200 girls who are chasing me along the promenade, Margate or Brighton or one of those. And I see coming towards me, Donovan with 200 girls chasing him. And I see a gentleman's toilet on the side of the road. And I say, quick, in here. And we go into this gentleman's toilet. And I say,
oh my God.
Who are you? And he goes, I'm Don. Oh, yeah, see, I know. I bought one of your records, man. I got, you know, oh, yeah. You know, only the Beatles ran away from girls. We were supposed to slow down for the quick, you know, the fit ones. But we didn't know. We were so naive. We were so tiny. But think
about
this.
So that must have been before you recorded Museum then.
Oh, yeah. So, I knew him for a long time. But what happened was that the audience was equally naive because we knew that they wouldn't come in the men's room. Girls wouldn't go. You know, nowadays, they'd be all over it.
Oh, they'd break the door down. Break the door down to get to you.
Well, now you can't even call it a men's room, so there's that.
Oh, Rose.
I know bad
people.
Don't
open that door, Rose.
Yeah, really. So, you know, I'm talking about the naivety of the time. And Donovan was naive, and he thought I'd saved him. I was an old timer compared to him. I was 17, but I had a few more hits than him. And, you know, he often talks about that. You know, it's those incredible moments in history where you run into people like like Johnny Cash came to my room in Nashville. Because he wanted to play he wanted to play me a new LP by Bob Dylan, and you know, stuff like that happens in the world of the pop star who hasn't got a clue and gets to meet Elvis Presley and the Everly Brothers outside the back door of a thing.
Well, because it is a very small circle at that point, you know?
Which is very, very appealing. You know, as a story, it's very appealing because everybody today, I get a feeling, is very much into their own worlds. They're not interacting, Jace.
You know, once upon a time, the British music scene was really, really small and very, very kind of trade union-like. You know, Everybody knew where everybody was. Everybody knew how much money they were getting. Everybody knew who was coming next week. Everybody knew where Herman's Hermits were in the charts. Everybody knew where, everybody knew where everybody was playing. And, you know, we'd all hang out together as musicians, not as friends. See, there's a difference. There's a strange camaraderie amongst musicians, which has been gone. You know, the minute you start American Idol and put people in competitions for who's best at something, you know, you ruin it. But, you know, I was the best turman. I wasn't the best drummer. And I didn't play the drums. See what I mean? No. So we all could hang out. And we didn't make records like anybody else. And nobody... And remember, I say all the time, The Who aren't like Herman's Hermits, and Herman's Hermits aren't like the Rolling Stones, and the Rolling Stones aren't like The Who, and The Who aren't like the Beatles, and the Beatles aren't like the Rolling Stones. Everybody was unique. Donovan suffered at the beginning because he wore a denim hat, and people said he's just another Bob Dylan. But, you know, he wasn't another Bob Dylan. He was a much better...
He hated
pop
that.
Singer.
Completely.
Yeah.
Rose,
I want you to tell the story, the connection between you and Peter.
When I was in university, I had a part-time job working for Sid Bernstein. And at the time, you know, he had brought in the Beatles, and, you know, I met him because he managed the Rascals. And I was booking acts for college acts at the time. And it was, so we kept up with all of that. And then they started Hullabaloo on NBC.
Yeah.
And, so that's how I got to see you guys really early on.
Okay.
Because I was at all of those concerts and everything. And I was still in college. So,
but Sid was a good guy. You know, Sid invited us to a club to see the Rascals, where they were young Rascals. And I sat at a table, and it was John Lennon, Bob Dylan, Peter Noon, and Captain Beefheart.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, it was amazing. I mean, those were really heady days. And so you imagine someone who's 17 and then, you know, being able to be in the dugout at Shea Stadium or... You know, like meeting all of these guys, it was really interesting. And but later on, when I was at Warner's, he worked for me, and we stayed friends his whole life. You know, and I was telling Jason that when he died, all of the people who he had helped, all of the people who he'd been there for, the only musician that showed up at his funeral was Lenny Kravitz.
Huh.
I was
Who's
really
my cousin?
Surprised about. Yeah.
Well, hopefully they were all working.
Yeah, hopefully. Oh,
see, again, look at who is this guy?
See, that
if
was lovely that you said
and
that.
Sainted in the next 20 minutes. This is like unbelievable. I love this guy's heart. Oh, my God.
Yeah.
Always thinking the positive for everyone.
Yeah, that's very sweet. We wanted to just a little bit, Peter, about how you got to be represented by Harvey Lisberg. Because it kind of falls into that story about everybody hanging out in the same places in those days.
Yeah, but I got a Sid Bernstein Presents poster here. I'm just going to read it. The topic got...
Oh, come on.
Oh.
Herman's Hermits, Saturday, June 12th, 1 o'clock, Academy of Music. Then underneath it, The Beatles, Sunday, August 15th at 8 o'clock, Shea Stadium. And underneath that, The Dave Clark 5 at the Academy of Music on Friday, June the 18th. And then below that, The Kinks and the Moody Blues at the Academy of Music on June the 19th. June 19th. So he had back-to-back shows at the Academy of Music. And he also,
amazing.
And he was advertising the first New York Folk Festival with Phil Oakes, Chuck Berry, folk singer, Johnny Cash,
yeah,
Buffy St. Marie, Muddy Waters, Dave Van Ronk, Bob Gibson, and John Hunt. Amazing. Mississippi, yeah. John Hunt.
Oh, my God. Oh,
yeah.
My God.
Do you know, Peter, that just a few weeks ago I was interviewed for this new documentary about Woodstock, and Sid was the first person to have the rights to go back 25 years later. He had the rights to Max Yasker's farm up there and everything else. And it was kind of a battle between, you know, one group and another group who was actually going to do that 25-year concert.
Huh.
And we went up there and, you know, we did our best to get the exit permits and everything with the town of Bethel. And it didn't work out, but for some, and then they went to Socrates. But at Bethel itself, and because of Sid, 100,000 people just showed up spontaneously on the 25th anniversary, August 15th,
huh,
and they all started singing and all, and then they built an impromptu stage, and Arlo Guthrie showed up, and you know, all these people, and Sid got on the stage. So it was a beautiful, heartfelt moment because people recognized Sid and what he was trying to do. And
yeah,
everything he predicted that was going to happen with that spot wound up happening. The museum, the concert space, everything. So people at Woodstock really remembered him. Yeah.
Yeah, because he was a nice person as well. So he'd come see me. Whenever I played in Jersey, he'd come to my shows.
Yeah.
With little Stephen and Felix and all those guys, you know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Anyway, we go back to the story about Harvey Lisberg and how he came into your life and your career.
Well, Harvey Lisberg was a Manchester University student, and he went to dinner with his family and their friends. And the woman, he said, I'd like to be like Brian Epstein and manage a band and travel the world and make millions of dollars. And this woman said, well, I saw this kid on the ferry across the Mersey. There used to be an all-night gig where people used to get drunk and slip around in their own vomit. Dancing, they called it. We'd been on it, you know. We used to play all-nighters, and an all-nighter meant we did reeling and rocking like for at least three times around the clock. So that's an inside rock and roll joke. But, you know, the joint was at 12 o'clock and the joint was packed. Dun, 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 and we'd go around the clock three or four times just to make up time. And she said she'd seen this kid on the boat and he was really good. So he came to see us at somewhere, some little youth club in Manchester. And he said, I'd like to be your manager. So I said, well, let's meet back at my mom and dad's house. My mom and dad had a beautiful, really posh house, and he came, and there was a baby grand piano, and he sat down at the piano and he played What Would I Say, like Jerry Lee Lewis, not the Ray Charles version, the Jerry Lee Lewis version. And we said, we don't want you to be in our manager, we want you to be in our band. He said, oh no, I don't want to be in the band, I'm too ugly. And so he became our manager, and immediately, because we had a manager, we moved up a little bit in the local society's eyes, you know. And he was a great hustler. We had five gigs a week because we'd realized that you couldn't be any good unless you played a lot. You know, you had to play a lot live and die and, you know, be reborn and stuff, find a song that saves your ass on stage, you know. So we built kind of, by working a lot, we had all these kind of special performances. Like, we didn't record most of them, but we did Jezebel, and it had all the, we'd taken an Everly Brothers song called Temptation. You came, I was alone. Temptation, da 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 da, and we put Jezebel over it, which was a Frankie Lane song, and it had a thing called pathos. You know, it would go night and day, da 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 da, everywhere, and it ended up like way down inside. On it was Jezebel, da 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 da. you know, so like the audience would, oh, wow, that was like a performance arrangement. And, you know, and all our songs started to have beginnings and endings, you know, they didn't just fizzle out. And we slowly got pretty good, I thought, you know, although nobody ever gave us a compliment, we thought we were getting better every day. And we decided, you know, basically after seeing the Beatles, that we needed to be no part-timers, you know, everybody had to quit their job. And one of the guys in Pete Novak and the Hobbits, he wouldn't quit his job because he was a bricklayer and it was good money and it was cash and he would like to be in the band at night, but he couldn't work all day because he was a piece worker on a building site. And so we got rid of him and replaced him with Keith Hopwood. And Keith Hopwood brought country music to the band. You know, he knew Chet Atkins and stuff like that. And we slowly started to grow. And all the time, Harvey Lisberg was there, who didn't have any musical ideas, but he knew that 10% of £6 was better than going to university. And yeah, we started to build. We were kind of we became a professional operation, you know. And for a year, we did the thing called noshlepping. We called it noshlepping. We went from every gig that you could get. My sister's friend was a hairdresser, and he was having a party, and we could do it for £5. And we would go and we'd load up the gun. We'd take the bus to gigs. And we had to wait for a double decker because you couldn't get the drums on a single decker, and you could put them under the stairs on the double deckers. And you know, me and Carl Green would go to gigs on our bikes and hide the bikes around the back of the club so the girls wouldn't bike.
Peter, was that difficult for you when you had to make that decision about being a professional musician? That this was the sole objective, this was a full-time job, and, you know, your bandmates, your friends, you know, guys that might have been in the band even before you, was it difficult to draw that line?
No, because I think, luckily for me, all those boys in Herman's Hermits believed that the 15-year-old idiot had the best idea at the time. You know, Keith Hopwood was a telephone engineer. He quit his job as a telephone engineer to play, you know, for less money than he made there, but to build this sort of... That's why it's an amazing amount.
To chase the dream.
We were not even friends, you know. We weren't friends, me and the Hermits. It was like, it's quite a strange thing. We were musical companions. We all liked the same kind of music. You know, I was a fan of Manchester United. Nobody else was. You know, we all had separate lives that didn't include each other. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Totally.
We were musically compatible.
And you know, again, you know, you're so young during this time. For you to be able to compartmentalize this and realize, you know, these aren't my mates. This is like going to, you know, if I'm a 9-to-5er, I'm going to the office and I want to work with people who are going to be equal or better to me to get the job done and have that commitment that I have. And I mean, just astounding that you clocked onto it so early.
Yeah, I did, but the things I missed, I mean, I did understand that you needed to be industrious. You needed to be what my father called it, but I think now it's called an entrepreneur. You got to hustle.
Yes.
Yeah, you know, because my father was a trombone player. Imagine how he had to hustle to get a gig. So,
right.
So, you know, it was about we could make a living doing this thing that we find so much pleasure in. Does that make any sense? You know, it could have been a stamp book.
Well, yeah, it's that old saying, you know, find something you love and you'll never work a day in your life. And my friend, you've had a lifetime holiday.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, I think so. You know, but you know, it hasn't all been glorious and fabulous. You know, I've had a few failures, but you know, I've learned from them. And you know, in Herman's Hermits, what I learned was that although we began all equal, you know, everybody got 20%. Everybody. With the five of us, we all shared all the record royalties and everything. But bit by bit, the lead singer gets drawn out of the group situation. It happens in every group. Yeah. Somebody's the lead singer. He gets all the interviews. Yeah. The camera's on him the whole time on Top of the Pops. So he becomes more famous than everybody else, right? And he does all the interviews. Well, in my naivety, I didn't realize I knew nothing about anybody else's feelings. And, you know, so we do the royal, we do a Royal Command performance, and the Queen historically only meets two people from every thing. You know, the Czechoslovakian ballerinas, she meets the lead dancer, male, and leads it. That's it. So for Herman's, and the one we were on was Tom Jones, Andy Williams, Herman's Hermits. Well, the Queen only met one of Herman's Hermits, and I didn't realize that the Hermits' mums would say, how come he gets to meet the...
Of course. Oh, no.
Always. Mm. And, you know, all that stuff goes on out of sight. And, you know, because I didn't think about it, I shared the dressing room with Andy Williams and Tom Jones with their bar and everything. And the Hermits were on the fourth floor with the dancers, and they weren't dancers. Oh, my God. They were equals, you know what I mean? And you don't realize that's going on at the time. So soon envy turns to hate, doesn't it? You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So, and I didn't see it coming because I was too naive. I was so self-centered that my ideas are always the best ones.
I think this has been one of the most exhilarating conversations we've had on the Sync Report. Something that really hit me in my heart is what you've just shared with our audience. And it's something we say repeatedly, you learn more from your failures. And it's that next step of getting up off the ground and trying again, which makes you the winner. And the fact that you're sharing these intimate moments, I just find it riveting and compelling and awestruck with everything about you, Peter. You're just incredible.
Well, you know, I have to get a lot of the credit goes to the people who insulted me when I was, including my father, you know. Well, those boys have got talent. You'll have to work a lot harder. Those kind of things inspire you, you know, because every Irishman, every person with one drop of Irish blood in them knows about revenge. And sometimes just getting even with somebody who said you're a one-hit wonder or you can't sing. And at the time when they say you can't sing, I said, well, neither can Bob Dylan, but look, he's doing it. You know what I mean? But eventually you say, well, what I've got was good enough to sell 60 million records, so what else have you got?
Yeah.
You know, so, I mean, you know, I think I had a good idea. I was just a kid, and I found a partner in Mickey Most who knew exactly what I was talking about, and he had the same dream that we'd build this band that would be appeal to, you know, the moms and the and everybody would, you know, because remember, once upon a time, we talk about Shea Stadium. Think of this time in history. Shea Stadium, 30,000 moms and dads drove their teenage girls to Shea Stadium, dropped them off and said, we'll be back tonight to pick you up. How many people would drop their kid? Mm. How many people would drop a kid off at Shea Stadium today and expect to ever see them again?
Do you know what the room under Shea Stadium looked like after that concert? I mean, there were girls that had fainted. There were girls that were crying. The parents would have to come to the bowels of Shea Stadium to get their daughters.
Forget the daughters, Rose. I'm having those feelings right now. You're going to have to come splash water on my face.
Okay.
Peter, you know, Paula mentioned in the introduction about the success you've also had with having your music synced in television and film over the years. I'm Into Something Good was used in the very popular comedy Naked Gun during a montage scene. And there are other, of course, many other instances where your music shows up. What is it like to have these songs out there in a different context and on the big screen or, you know, whatever? How's that been?
It's the way that, my songs get used in the movies that is the most rewarding. I'm into something good in the Naked Gun. They're skipping along the beach singing, woke up this morning feeling fine. Da, da, da. And it's kind of a spoof. It's kind of a spoof on romantic songs. But that's what people were like. People were like that. And, you know, the End of the World got in the... That chess TV, that chess.
Oh, yes, we're going to talk about that in a minute. Yes,
Yeah.
Well, think about it. Think about it. The End of the World is the perfect teenage boy song and the perfect teenage girl song. And the fact that those people who put it in the movie knew that, what that boy was saying in that song could fit for everybody else. That's a big reward to me. You know, why does the sun? Why does the sun go on shining? Why does the sea? They know that none of that works anymore because you don't love me anymore. Nobody dares say stuff like that anymore. Nobody. No, people are afraid of putting their heart out there. But that's a kid.
They're afraid of sentimentality. They're very afraid of sentimentality.
People in my generation were secretively very romantic. I mean, all the songs from my generation were songs that people could sing, they could speak for you.
I think we missed that.
I was gonna say, Rose, that's sad that we've lost that. Yeah.
It's very sad, but then you see filmmakers like my son, Peter, who you know, a lot of the filmmakers I work with who are in their 30s, you know, and came up in the indie world or, you know, who are making careers, they go back to that music. They're not necessarily putting what's happening now. They have a really good understanding of the music of the 60s and 70s, and more than you would think. And they're using them, you know, in their films. So there is still hope.
No, but you know, we don't want to sound like old people. I'm just saying, luckily, some people can listen to a song from any period and go, oh, that will work in what we want people to be thinking during this scene. That's
of
all.
Of course. But just like you were picking up on, you know, the 40s and 50s from your dad and mom and your grandma, these kids have grown up with us and they've heard this music. They really appreciate Jerry and the Pacemakers and Herman's Hermits and the Beatles and obviously the Stones and everything.
And they feel like they're discovering them, don't they, Rose? It's like,
really, really do. And I mean, look what Scorsese did for the Stones. I mean, that's a perfect example of what Marty, you know, has always been able to do with his soundtracks. But, you know, those are films that live on forever. And that music is there forever. It's evergreen, and it's always going to be there.
You know, this is Kevin. I had to jump in. I mean, this is just such an enchanting interview. It feels like a movie. The interview really does. It feels like a movie. And, you know, I'm a filmmaker, and I know how important music is. And, you know, I really do have to say that, you know, a great song is a great song. It stands the test of time. It just stands the test of time. So your music definitely is iconic. And to hear how iconic your band was is a testament to why your music has been placed in all these films and TV shows. I have to speak on one of my favorite TV shows back in the day, The Wonder Years, because really used music that was popular in those times.
And changed television.
It did. Yeah. And, you know, there's so many shows that really do, you know, have the feel. And a big part of that is music. Music is half of it, really. So, you know, I think that we have a clip of There's a Kind of Hush.
Oh, yeah, great
song.
On
an episode. Yeah, absolutely.
My favorite. Yeah.
And it was used where Paul is too shy to ask a girl to dance at the prom and his friend Kevin. And every time I watch that show, whenever they say Kevin.
There's Kevin. Like, oh.
You know, he helped to play matchmaker to the song.
Yeah, go for it, Milfredo. The sounds of lovers in love. You know what I mean? Just the two of us and nobody else. In sight, there's nobody else. And I'm feeling good, just holding you tight. So listen, baby.
gorgeous.
Incredible. Beautiful.
Great song.
Earlier on, you touched on your song, The End of the World, being used in The Queen's Gambit.
Yeah.
Which obviously was a huge Netflix hit in 2020. Massive. And, you know, that series used some iconic music to set the time period. But that song so eloquently captures the emotion of the characters in the scene. You know, there's no dialogue, just the music and the body language of the mother and daughter. And for those of you listening, you can hear it play in season one, episode three, I think it is. And I think we have a clip of it now, if you don't mind us playing it. Spin it, Milfredo. Let me take a listen.
Why does the sun go on shining? Why does the sea rush to shore? Don't they know it's the end of the world when you don't love me anymore?
Such a good song. Nancy Sinatra covered that as well.
Yeah, a lot of people did it.
No, it's perfect.
I have a friend, his name is Carlos Rafael Rivera. He actually won an Emmy for The Queen's Gambit. And, you know, I talk to him all the time about the importance of the music for that particular show. And, you know, they would go back and forth and back and forth about which songs are right, how it feels for that specific time period. And, you know, I can say that to have that particular song included in that particular show and that scene, I mean, it really, really made that scene.
Got a lot of people called me on that when they saw that to say that they'd seen it and how perfect it was for the moment and all that. So it's a work of genius for the guy to pick that song for that scene because it made it more poignant.
Peter, do you find when you get these, you know, iconic placements, do you see a younger audience when you're playing live, more fan mail, more reactions on your social media? Does it have a deep impact for you?
Big impact because it's kind of a reward system, you know. Everything that happens that has your name on it or your sound on it, you know, like when I do I'm Into Something Good on stage, people maybe know it from My Little Toaster. I don't know where people know, but they've heard it 500 times. You see, once upon a time, I go on stage and I sing songs. I'm having trouble explaining this. I go on stage and I sing songs and people go, oh, yeah, I know this song. But they didn't buy the record. If there's 5,000 people in the audience, only 60 of them brought a Herman's Hermits record. But we used to hear the songs for free on the radio and stuff like that. Now there isn't anything like that. So wherever anybody hears your song, it's a new... You know what I mean? If they're watching Netflix and they hear one of my songs, then they come to a concert and I do it in the show, they go, oh, this is that song from the Netflix. Doesn't matter when, just as long as you know the song. And people sing along to There's a Kind of Hush. You know, I go, There's a Kind of Hush all over the world. Everyone gets going on that one and everybody sing. They sing the background parts and I'm It's Something Good. You know, the world is... If you go and see a modern band in England now, like when they play live and stuff like that, people sing along now. It's become a musical thing again. It used to be a fashion show, remember?
Yeah.
There's so many actors now who are like turning into musicians and want to have bands and everything. I mean, that crossover is interesting. What do you think?
Lots of my friends who are actors, I've been to see them live and show. You know... You can't be a part-timer at anything. I think you've got to give it all of it.
Yeah.
And I think if you've got something to fall back on, you may think of that. It might take some of the edge from the front.
Yeah. But there's a kind of a myth for like guys who are actors. They think there's this amazing myth that it's so much cooler to be a musician.
Well, it is, isn't it?
Peter.
Jeff Bridges used to be in a band and he was really good and it was a good band and he's still good live, but he's a much better actor. I don't know, but I've never seen him, but he's a very good actor. And I,
hey, look, he's gone back to music and it's done quite well.
He went
well
back to
him.
Music as the first thing he did.
Our own host, Colin O'Donoghue, started as a musician and now he's like this huge actor.
Yeah.
But I think deep down, Colin, tell me if I'm wrong. You miss that. You miss that live engagement. You miss being on stage, being, you know, musically rather than
Yeah, it's a different thing. I mean, obviously we're not talking about me, but I was 16 when I started acting, but I'd been playing the guitar since I was 11, you know, so over 30 years now, and it was just it's just something I was always passionate about. But yeah, you missed a lot. I used to gig, Peter, in a band. I used to play like 5 nights a week, you know, when I was an out of work actor. So I know what it's like to sort of, you know, try and scrape a living playing in a band.
At the beginning, it's bad, but you know, now you get to fly on a plane and stuff like that. It's not a van, but there's something about having everybody in the band in the same van all the same time. You know, the Beatles would sing along with each other and write songs, you know, and then they've got their own cars, and it's sort of all fizzled away. But you know, actors. They tell you what to do. You know, the actor's most important person to an actor is going to be the director. You stand over here and you need a motivation to go and walk over to there. Musicians don't need a motivation. I'm going to play this song because I like it.
Right.
So yeah, it's a completely different game.
But you're telling a story. You know what I mean?
Yeah. So yeah.
It goes back to like storytelling, I think, with a song.
My live stage show is one story about me. You know, I woke up this morning feeling fine.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I sing to Mrs. Brown's mother. I sing to Mrs. Brown.
You're still out there, you know, gigging whatever, 180 plus shows a year, which is an incredible amount of shows.
Crazy.
You know, and your songs still continue to be used by many directors and music supervisors and stuff like that. And so, I mean, what is the what's the secret to your longevity and seemingly inability to age?
I think it's he's a persistent little shit, and
that's what Donovan said.
Yeah, I'm not going away. I'm not going away.
Thank God. I hope you never do, Peter.
I'm not done. I think I've only just started.
Yeah.
Oh, you know, I've got loads to do. I'm having some more fun now doing live concerts than I ever did in my life, because you know, the audience is so ready for somebody with a good attitude. They know I'm not going to mention politics. They know I'm not going to mention where's the donkey. You know, they know I'm not going to do that. So they feel that they come and sing along and have a laugh. And now what I do is I do other people's songs. And because I can, people like, they don't mind me doing a Dave Clark 5 or a Beatles song, or because they aren't doing them anymore.
Mm.
No, that's right.
Incredible.
Great songs are great songs, aren't they?
I feel like this is only the tip of the iceberg, this conversation. I'd imagine that we could sit here for hours and hours just listening to these incredible stories that you have. And, you know, it was an amazing experience to have you with us tonight and sharing these great stories from your amazing career. But I think it's time that we should probably let you go. And then to our listeners,
I want to say thank you, Colin,
for spending your time with us as well.
Hey, Colin, it's great talking to you.
Yeah, well, listen, Peter, it was an absolute pleasure. Honestly, it was such an amazing conversation to hear your story, you know, and it's fascinating for me, and I'm sure it's absolutely fascinating for everybody and for joining us.
Hey, thank you, everybody.
Hey, guys.
Hey, Jace.
Hey, Jason. You okay?
Yeah, I'm good. Just buried in paperwork.
Oh, for the sync report.
Not this time. Move me no mountain.
That indie film your music supervising?
Yeah.
Sounds like a great project. What's the problem?
It's a brilliant film and we're building a great soundtrack, but you can't imagine how much paperwork I deal with for these films.
Have you heard of Sync Lodge?
First, you got to draft up the sync request forms.
I've heard of Sync Lodge.
Then drafting and issuing contracts.
Yep, Sync Lodge is great, Paula. It does everything a music supervisor needs.
Then deliver the cue sheet. It never ends.
Doesn't Sync Lodge do all of that automatically?
Sweat Lodge? What are you guys banging on about? I got real issues I'm sharing with you guys.
Yeah, lots of issues.
We're trying to tell you, Jason. Sync Lodge is a new platform for music supervisors. It helps you to source the music, sync songs against scenes, draft up sync requests, and even creates the cue sheets once you've locked in the music to the film.
Oh, Sync Lodge does all that?
It's true, Jason. I just started using it for the sync report. And it's not only saving time, but it's so easy to use. I'm actually enjoying the work.
You guys are the best. Sync Lodge sounds amazing and exactly what I need for music supervising. Why am I always the last one to hear about these things?
I've been telling you about Sync Lodge for weeks.
Don't feel bad, Edge, for not telling me sooner. I know you're busy. You're a good guy.
Paula, is my mic on? Can you hear me?
Loud and clear, Edge.
Guys, what's the name of that program again?
Sync Lodge.
That is something to scream about. Yes, you too can be cool like Edge and use cutting edge technology to help you with your film and TV productions. No matter if you're a music supervisor, director, producer, editor, save time and increase proficiency with Sync Lodge.
I need to find a new gig.
Sync opportunities, sync opportunities.
Okay, we're going to continue finding music for this amazing film, this documentary that we've been working on all month. You know, again, it's not just, you know, 90s and 2000 hip hop, but we're looking for classic rock, country, swamp music. All right, let's say hello to a couple of my favorite ladies. Hello, Lisa Dunn. How's it going? How's your weekend going?
Oh boy, it's busy.
Yes.
I've been doing some research on Kumho D and really diving in, and also have about 10 music projects I'm working on at the moment.
Yeah, you just got back from LA. I figured you'd be inundated with things.
Well, yeah, I was literally just recording a work tape right before I came on here that's kind of due for feedback today. So.
Oh, God. Oh, no. The conflict between the sync report and your real life. It's happening. It's happening. Hello, Connecticut. Hi, Jody Lynn.
Hello. How is everyone?
We're hanging in there. Hey, the weather's changed in Ireland. It's cold. It's rainy. The deer are grumpy. The fox are wet. The cat is soaking.
Same here. It's getting very cold and the heat's coming on and the blankets are coming out and I am in absolute denial.
The coziness, though. I love that. I kind of like the cold. I like layering, and I like the blankets. I like cozy.
Until the good storms and the winter and the snow and crazy
it's
stuff.
It's still summer here.
What? That's crazy. Well, all right. Well, I hope you're staying cool, Lisa, and I hope you're staying warm, Jody. Heather, are you warm or cold?
I am a little bit cold because I had to turn off the heating in my house to do some vocals because it was like making all this noise and it was.
Oh, you can't have the background. No, you can't have the background sounds.
No, it's awful.
Awful. Oh, but that is that. So I hope you're drinking like warm honey or some kind of warm tea.
No, I'm just eating peanut butter and jelly like I always do. I've been
that's the best for singing. Yeah, that's great. That's every vocal coach will say, have a bit of peanut butter before you sing.
I never said I was disciplined.
Yeah. Well, we're learning this slowly, Heather. You're a trickster because you're incredibly disciplined. You're very organized, but we're now getting a glimpse into your personal life. Oy vey, what a mess. All right. Excellent. Well, oh my God, I see Vinks. Vinks, I'm so sorry. We were supposed to talk. I've been moving all weekend and packing. I'm in moving hell and production hell and contract hell. But how are you? How is France, my friend?
Dude, I am in heaven. I just discovered
heaven.
That they have edible underwear. And I'm just, the thought of that. And they said it's kind of like the consistency of What was it? Fruit roll-ups.
And they that's cut exactly what it is. Wait, you've never heard of this before? Come on.
I've never asked to eat somebody's edibles, you know. I have to think about it now. You know, I'm afraid it's totally, might taste like black fruit licorice or something.
It's
just
fruit roll-ups, Jeff. It's fruit roll-ups with leg holes and a crotch. It's very weird.
Uh-oh. Life is good, man.
Awesome. Excellent, Vinks. Thank you. Okay. And I see my directors on stage. Hello, Kev. How's it going?
That was a weird place to come in.
That was weird for everybody. I think Paula Flack. I see Paula. Paula, my producer. I love it. Paula, how's it going?
Hello.
Hello.
Good, thanks.
You sound really good tonight. What's going on? You sound happy.
I'm good. I'm fine. there's no reason. This is just me every day.
It's because you're hanging. It's because it's our night. This is because this I'm is like so, it's like our date night.
Exactly. I love our date night.
Superfan.
Superfan.
It's because I'm messaging you in the background going, stop saying that. Don't say that.
Oh, no, I haven't been looking. What did I say?
Nothing. I'm not going to repeat it.
No, we won't. Don't out me. Don't out me. So what are we doing tonight? We're listening to...
More submissions, yeah, for the boys of 742. We're still listening to songs for them. And then I believe, yeah, we're going to send on whatever we think is suitable.
Okay, awesome. All right, that's great. We could do this. Actually, there's some really interesting talks going behind the scenes regarding this film and the Sync Report's involvement. Very exciting stuff. I know that Vinks is going to be a key factor in creating the music that we don't find. But I don't know. We've been on fire here. I think like 90% of what we've played has actually gone into the bag for consideration for the director and producers. So hats off to this community because it's filled with the most badass talent I've come across in 30 years. Oh my God, I'm so old. 30 years of doing this crazy job. All right, before we start playing music, I have to welcome the fabulous, the always on time, Milfredo 7. I know you're working away on a remix of Patty's song, The World exactly, is Stranger, yeah. for Kevin.
Yeah, that's it. Yeah, it's not the easiest, only because he's such a perfectionist, Patty, isn't he? So it's just like, man, this has got to be
precious.
Flawless. I'm gonna give it him and then just go on holiday for 2 weeks just in case.
Yeah,
like
turn
it.
Your phone off. Yeah. Smart.
Yeah,
smart
and then he's man. Got no choice but to accept it.
We
then.
Might not that's just play it to him. Let's just let him be surprised when he sees the show.
That's it. Play it and run. That's my policy. Yeah. Don't
I
give
love
a chance.
That technique.
Yeah. Just don't answer your phone. That's it. All
play
good.
It and run.
I'm all about asking forgiveness. Don't ask for permission. Ask for forgiveness.
You could come to the church and ask for forgiveness. The church of Milfredo. It's happening. It's happening.
I'm coming. I need to repent, my friend. Oh God, do I gotta repent? All right, we're talking about repenting. I'm repenting through playing you guys, my panel, the greatest of music from my community. Look at me, I'm very me tonight. What a pig. My community, the Sync Report. this is our Sunday. This is how we have communion. Heather, Paula, who's introducing? What's happening here? Do we have
this is
a
your
first
life.
Song?
Who are you? What are you
Heather,
on?
Heather, I'm talking to Heather. Forget you, Paul. Oh, wait.
Blue and gold. Looking up to rain and gold. Your smile brings warm to the hurt. You are the wise one who still plays in the dirt. Blue and gold. The sunshine still shows in the cold. The dark I relinquish. A wise woman's grin makes sorrow look foolish. Perfection is just a handful of pixie dust. Through the night, on a plane, through your own madness, you laugh at what's insane. Blue. Sunshine still screams in the cold. The dark I relinquish to the wise woman's grin that makes sorrow feel foolish.
Dante, wow, what a gorgeous tune.
Oh,
where are you guys?
We're in Manhattan, New York.
Oh, fantastic. Not a cooler place. I love it. Very cool, very cool. And please, Dante, tell me a bit about that gorgeous song.
I wrote that song about a year ago, I think, if I remember right. It's just, I was using just a lot of visuals in it. You know, I wanted it to kind of be like sort of like cinematic in its opening and throughout, trying to be, kind of open-ended with the actual story and the idea behind it. With a lot of stuff I try to do that, I try to stay a little bit ambiguous to let it kind of go where it needs to go for within people's own minds.
Thanks. You want to weigh in?
It painted the picture of where it was, the vibe, just the thought process. Everything was there. Just it's going to be great tool for you when you figure out where you want to use it, when you want to put it, which words you want to pronounce. The vibe is great. I actually loved it. Yeah, I miss that, because these new days, they don't spend time to develop the punchline. They just get to it in the first 10 seconds and that's it. There is no, there's no story to be told. So I appreciated it.
Yeah, no, I'm with you. I loved, the lyrics were really, like he's actually, like Dante was saying, they're really quite ambiguous. It could go really with quite a few different narratives. But I think, musically too, that, the guitar and, really, really cool. All right,
Thank you. Thank you guys so much. I really appreciate the time consideration.
Thanks, Dante. I hope you keep submitting. I love what you're doing, man. Really, really cool.
Great. Thank you.
So thank you for that submission. Paula Flack, who is next?
Are you finished?
Don't ever do that again.
Here's a reason Jason is not a vocalist.
I am not a singer.
There's a reason Jason lives in the countryside singing to animals. Next, we are listening to I'm Destruction and Chaos by Abs K. Play it, Milfredo.
I love it.
I'm destruction and chaos.
Come with me. I can make you live a thousand dreams. Can take
spell it, I'll make you believe that you can penetrate through this heart wrapped up in stone. How can you be so naive? I'm destruction and chaos. Won't stop till your world.
So cool. So I am Madness and Mayhem. Let's go make a family. Oh my God. Catherine, welcome back to the stage. You haven't been on stage in quite a while. Obviously you're working away on incredible, incredible work. Your voice there, I don't know, kind of really made me think of Joan Jett. I dug the track. The beginning of that song was so risky and so cool. I really, really liked it. And then it was like, it started, I was like, oh, am I going to like the track? What do I think? But yeah, by the middle of that track, I'm in love. I'm in love with it. Just like, I think you were on maybe a couple weeks or a month ago with another track that was a little bit out there and original. Yeah, we have to know more about you. Please say hello. Tell us about that track.
Hiya.
Welcome back.
Hi, thank you. So, yeah, that track sort of sums up why I'm single, really.
But you know what? I can't understand it. I don't understand it. I think that is just, you should have the guys banging down your door to have a minute of your time, I'll tell you.
No, and then I thought it would work quite well for the brief, you know, coming perfectly from taking the drugs point of view, that it basically messes up your complete life and ruins everything. No, and it takes control of you from, like, you know, from taking the drugs. And the trippy bit in the middle would fit if you were sort of, you'd taken the drugs in the scene and you were having the, you know, the trip that comes with it sort of thing and getting all disorientated and everything.
100%. The lyric fit, you know, exactly what we're looking for. And even, you know, I don't want to call this dated at all, but there was definitely, like I mentioned Joan Jett, you know, there's like that, you know, kind of blowback kind of feel to it. Yeah, incredible. You're incredible. Let's hear what the panel has to say. Milfredo, you want to start us off? Kevin, you want to shout out next?
Yeah, Catherine, correct me if I'm wrong. I think you submitted for the Christmas special.
She did. Oh, she had an awesome.
My favorite Christmas song
ever.
Yes, that's right. That's <the one. laughs> Yeah, yeah. So I know your vibe.
She's gonna be on every party list of mine. She's such an antisocial. I love this woman.
Has to be. Yeah. Yeah. So I loved that Christmas song. This one I don't love as much, but I do really, really like the song. I mean, it came in and that same kind of way that Christmas song came in, and then, you know, I mean, Chaos. I mean, it really, really set the tone. I'll put it to
and
you that
destruction.
Way. Yeah, I mean, so Milfredo mentioned one of my favorite groups, Skunk Anansie, which, you know, they always went hard the guitars were hard, the drums were hard, everything, you know, was destruction and chaos. And, it, you know, they're still around. And so for, and again, Catherine, I love your music. I agree with Milfredo, the juxtaposition of, you know, your kind of, you know, uninterested voice with a little bit more harder edge to the song, I think would have just capped it off. With that being said, I think the song serves the exact purpose of the brief. It serves the exact purpose of the movie, actually. And it could,
we could easily find 35 seconds, 40 seconds of that song, which would sync perfectly. I agree with you, Kev.
Yeah. Yeah. So, and you know, just to cap it off, you know, Catherine, you're one of my favorite artists.
Thank you very much. Yeah, that was really nice.
We're going
to
use
know.
That Christmas song. And we said this, you know, we put it in the bag for the Sync Report, by hook or crook, if I have to fight everybody in the whole staff.
No one's going to fight on that one. Keep submitting, keep doing what you're doing, because you're brilliant.
Oh, thank you so much. That's really made my day.
Thank you. You made mine. Let's put that in the bag, Heather. Paula, who's next?
I love that we made her day. I love that. Right, next up, we are listening to Falling by Agat. Spin it, Wilfredo.
I think I might just be okay. I think I might just be okay. I think I'm finished, let it in and let it out now. Think I held my breath enough to let it go now. If bricks are falling from the walls, I let them bricks fall from the walls. I think I'm finished, let it in and let it out now. I think I held my breath enough to let it go now. Ooh. Ooh. Think I can let it go now. I see you all the time. I think I might just be alright. I think I might just be alright. Is this serenity or something I can hold to? I got my fingers crossed, hoping it will fall through. Just wanna listen, sound and clear, to all those things I never hear. Is this serenity or something I can hold to? I got my fingers crossed, hoping they will fall through. I think it's time for me to fly. I think it's time to fly so high. They say the wind will follow where you wanna blow it. They say the sun will rise however you may know it. A glimpse of light, a shooting star. They had me thinking I'd get so far. They say the wind will follow where you wanna blow it. They say the sun will rise however you may know it.
Track. I really dig it. So many cool sounds. As a music supervisor, I'm having myself over here. Agat, welcome back to the stage. How are you doing?
Hey. Good to be here.
Hey, yourself. How is Tel Aviv?
Tel Aviv is okay. Just starting to get a bit cold.
Oh, it's starting to get cold. It's cold in Ireland too. But that track was hot. That track was really cool. A lot of fun. I again, you know, they're just even, you know, just getting our hands on the instrumental of that. But I love your voice. I just, you know, what fun it would be to be trapped in the studio with you. Tell us a little bit about that song, and then let's let the panel kind of weigh in.
Yeah, so that song was called Falling. It's from my previous album that was released like 2 years ago, maybe almost three. I worked on this song with producer Neil Horowitz. He actually just moved to Nashville like a year ago. But before, I got the chance to be in the studio with him, and he's one of the most amazing producers that I ever got to work with. And I wrote this song with an MS-20, which is a synthesizer that I really like, which is, it's monophonic. And then all of the sounds and the rhythms in the song and the album entirely were very influenced by this instrument that I got my hands on. And then we brought to the studio some of our amazing friends and musicians to play. Gal Oved is one of them who played most of the keys in this song. And then here we are, but that song was called Falling. Yeah.
So cool. So cool. All right, let's open it up to the panel. Milfredo, what'd you think of that crazy track?
Such Thank a nice sound. That is on point again. Yeah, I loved it. And I loved that. It was just, it sounded now. Do you know what I mean? It was just, it didn't fit any kind of pigeonhole, you just totally. Doing your thing. Yeah. And so many parts, but they linked beautifully. You know what I mean? It was like, there was so much going on, but nothing sounded out of place. It really didn't. So, I just love the freshness of it.
Thank you, Milfredo. Thank you. Yep. I'm with you.
Thank you.
All right. So that was fun. What a great night. See you next Sunday when Lisa will sing some Thomas Dolby.
Oh God.
The Sync Report cast will be back with you next week with your hosts Rose Ganguza, Jason P. Rothberg, and myself, Colin O'Donoghue. Until next time, take care and be kind.
Thank you for listening. Tune in next week.
Today's episode was produced by Jason P. Rothberg, Kevin Sharpley, Paula Flack, and Robert Capadonna. It was written by Jason P. Rothberg, Kevin Sharpley, Lisa Dunn, and Paula Flack. Editing was by Jason P. Rothberg, Milfredo Seven, Paula Flack, Edgar Edge Kameh, and Adam McNamara. Research by Lisa Dunn. Graphic design by Jody Lynn Talevi. Brought to you by Zavatar.